Welcome everyone to the Do Good Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Watson, and I'm really excited for today's guest. His name is Mark Gober. He is an author of The End to Upside Down Thinking, which won the IPPI Award for the best science book of the year. He's also the author of a number of books in that series, whether it be The End to Upside Down Living, End to Upside Down Liberty, and most recently, The End to Upside Down Medicine. He's also the host of the podcast Where Is My Mind? Additionally, he serves on the board of Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell's Institute for Noetic Science and the School of Wholeness and Enlightenment. But before that, Mark graduated with high honors from Princeton University, was a partner at Sherpa Technology Group in Silicon Valley, and also worked as an investment bank analyst at UBS in New York. So, but firstly, Mark, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
So I think it'd be really useful for us to just get a little bit of an understanding, because you've obviously taken quite a change of direction over the past, say, half a dozen years or more. But just get a bit of an understanding of kind of that journey that you went on. Be brilliant.
This whole journey for me has been very much unexpected, because I was on such a mainstream path in my life. When I graduated from Princeton, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I thought I wanted to go into business generally. And like a lot of my classmates, investment banking was one of the top options for building a platform and a business career. So I decided to go into investment banking, and that was in 2008. So this was during the financial crisis, is right when I started, summer of 2008 into the fall. So I lived through all that stuff from the inside, working in New York. And pretty quickly, I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do long term in my career, but I stayed there until 2010 and then joined another firm, first in the office in Boston, Massachusetts, and then in Silicon Valley, California, where I ended up spending 10 years. And the company did somewhat different work than what I did in New York, but it was somewhat similar too. So, kind of a still on that more traditional business track, even though I was working with technology and new innovations, it was still a pretty traditional path. And behind all of it, when I was working and just living life, generally speaking, I thought life did not have meaning to it, that we exist, but our existence is just a random occurrence, and that the universe is fundamentally meaningless beyond what we create in our own minds. So it was a nihilistic perspective. It's one that might align with atheism or agnosticism, the idea that there is no spiritual reality to our existence, and that when we die, that's the end of our sense of experiencing life. There's no soul. That was my worldview. And I thought that the more we learned in science, the more we were moving away from what I would have considered superstitious beliefs from spirituality and religious traditions. So eventually, I hit a wall in many ways in my life. Starting around 2014, 2015, and into 2016, where I just didn't have a good sense of direction, and some things in my personal and professional lives weren't going the way that I wanted. And I was just kind of like, why am I here? I'm just going through the motions. I'm on a treadmill trying to accomplish the next thing. What's the meaning behind all of it? And what I concluded was there is no meaning, and I wasn't going to try to look for new meaning. And what happened was in 2016, I came across podcasts that challenged those worldviews. Initially, I heard an episode on Extreme Health Radio. A woman named Laura Powers was being interviewed, talking about energy and the spiritual dimension as it relates to health and well-being. And I hadn't heard people really talk about that in a serious way. And then I listened to more podcasts like it on the Healing Powers podcast and many others, and started to read books. And pretty quickly in 2016, by the end of the year, I realized something was up, that I had to rethink my life. And long story short, I've now written six books as I've began to look at many areas of life, not just the spiritual existential realm, but other areas where I believed something. And now I think that there's a new paradigm to explore. And I even left my job, the one in Silicon Valley. I had become a partner at the firm. And right before everything happened with the lockdowns, not knowing that was going to happen, I decided to leave the firm. And over the last few years, have just been writing and continuing to question my paradigms.
It sounds really fascinating. I'm interested to know about the actual transition, because often sometimes people will have a shift and a change of awareness and then want to pursue a different path. Some people can literally want to jump off the side of a cliff without a parachute and just go all in for it. Did you go on a little bit of a transition where you're like, okay, I'm not ready to leave that all behind. I need to maybe think about, even though you're exploring all these different elements, but we need to still kind of be a little bit grounded in this reality, thinking about the basics of how, we've all got, whether it's a mortgage or pension, rent to pay and everything, the element to it. Did you have, what was the shift like for that?
Well, it was gradual. So 2016 is when I first got wind of a paradigm shift, and I didn't officially leave my firm until end of 2019, early 2020. So it took a while, and I was trying to orient myself. And because when I was in this place of just not being very satisfied with life generally, and on top of it, I was developing a new worldview. So it was a disorienting period where I didn't feel like I had any grounding. And I didn't know there were other people that thought about these topics. I thought I was isolated. And now I know there's a huge community globally that knows about this stuff already, and I'm late to the party. So it took me a while to just adjust to that and to also build confidence in the worldview. And that's part of what the writing books has done for me, is that it allows me to solidify the ideas, because I'll have ideas about things, but it's when I write it and actually cite all the sources and go through that exercise, it helps to solidify for me. I actually wrote my first book in the summer of 2017. It was published in 2018. So this is while I was working. So I tried to keep a parallel track, because I didn't know that I would leave my firm. I mean, I'd spent so much time there, eventually a decade, building a career in that area. But it wasn't until I reached a tipping point where I realized I needed to do something else. So I think for each of us, it's probably different depending on life circumstances, how we can manage these things. And for me, it became too difficult to feel like I had one foot in the door of the traditional professional life and having to deal with clients, and then having these other interests. The energies were pulling each other in different directions to a point where I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, that definitely seems like a I wouldn't say common in some ways, but kind of natural. It's just, it comes to a certain point, doesn't it, where as you say, that energy through it either just like it just pulls you down and you realize like there's something else. And it's basically more like you're following the excitement, you're being drawn to something new and some of the things that you've explored, because I'm really interested in all those things, particularly in the your first book with End to Upside Thinking. Some of the things, psychic phenomenon and near-death experiences and quantum physics, when you first tap into that information, it's like, wow, it blows, absolutely blows your mind and you get so excited to that stuff. So I'd love to get into that element of it and hear about that book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still excited about that topic, but when I first learned about it, I was so mind blowing. It's all I wanted to do was talk about it. And I had to learn, and I've had to learn this as I've gone into other topics, is not everyone is so interested in all this, or maybe they will be, and it's 10 years from now or 20 years from now. So everyone's on their own time horizon. And I've learned, and books and doing interviews like this are a good way to get the information out and express my excitement without having to thrust it on people. Like, people can read my books if they want, or they can listen to this, but it's not being forced on them. So I try to be very hands off with this, because if it's someone who's not ready, it doesn't go well. But all that said, the big shift for me was around the nature of consciousness. And it took me a while to actually hone in on that point, because at first I was learning about near-death experiences, like you said, and looking at findings in quantum mechanics, and learning that there are studies suggesting that psychic phenomena are real in ordinary people, even though it's a subtle effect often, and even though it's just statistically significant and not a major thing, it's still something beyond what chance would predict. I was learning about all these things individually, and I realized that they all related to consciousness, meaning that the way that we experience. So consciousness is the part of us actually that has the capacity to experience anything. If we have a thought, it's a thought that appears within our consciousness. If we feel something, it's always something we feel in our consciousness. If we see, the sight is registered within our consciousness. So consciousness is central to life, because without it, we wouldn't even be able to ask questions or have these sorts of conversations. And what I didn't realize until I started researching is that science doesn't really understand consciousness. There's something known as the hard problem of consciousness, which the way that I like to oversimplify it is to say that our consciousness is something that we can't touch. It's not physical. Like, I can touch my leg or the chair, but I can't touch consciousness. Consciousness is an abstraction. It's not physical. Whereas the body and the brain, these are physical elements of our biology. And science doesn't understand how something non-physical like consciousness could come out of something physical like a brain or a body. We know that the body has some relation to the way that we experience life. So, for example, in the field of neuroscience, there are many, many examples of, they're called neural correlates of consciousness, NCCs for short, where if part of the brain is damaged, then we can see a corresponding shift in a person's consciousness. So let's say the part of the brain responsible for vision becomes damaged. That person might have a change in the way they see. We can say, look, this part of the brain changed. This is how their consciousness changed. There's a strong correlation here. What many people do, and I think societally we tend to do this, but also in the field of neuroscience, tend to jump to the conclusion, well, it must be the case that the brain is creating our consciousness because that correlation is so tight. Therefore, the brain is what's responsible for producing our conscious experience. The problem with that thinking, it's one of logic, really, that you can't conclude that because two things are related to each other, that one causes the other. And the way people say that in statistics is correlation does not necessarily imply causation. And Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, a philosopher in this area, he's used an analogy, which interestingly I've been using in my new book on medicine too, because it relates to a similar logical flaw, is he says, if you have firefighters at the scene of a fire, do we conclude that the firefighters cause the fire? And we can see if there's a bigger fire, there might be more firefighters. So, like, clearly the firefighters must have caused the fire, right? Or what if we said that the fire has a mystical ability and it creates firefighters out of thin air? So when you have a fire, firefighters are going to be there because the fire created it. The point is that when you have observations in science, there's a separate step that's required to show a causal link between one thing and the other. And we see that with consciousness, where people say, well, the brain must create consciousness because there's tight correlations. And the argument that I make in my book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, and also my podcast series, Where Is My Mind, is that the brain doesn't create consciousness, but rather the brain is processing consciousness in some other way, meaning consciousness exists beyond the body, beyond the brain, and our brain and our body system, how in some way is filtering it, is receiving it and transmitting it like an antenna, something. But consciousness is not localized to the brain-body system. That is a very different way of looking at life, because if what I just said is true, then consciousness can exist outside the body, independently of the body, meaning when your body dies, consciousness can continue. So that would mean that you don't die, actually, that our sense of experiencing exists beyond the body. And it also implies that psychic phenomena could be real, that consciousness could be outside of space and time, outside of your brain. And to go back to Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, he has an analogy that all of reality could be likened to a stream of water, where the water is analogous to consciousness, and each of us as an individual is like a whirlpool within that overall stream. So we have a sense of being an individual, but we're interconnected as part of something bigger at the same time. So it's a paradox that there's individuality and some kind of collective at the same time. And if water from one whirlpool gets out of that whirlpool and goes to another whirlpool, the analogy there is that it's like some of my consciousness getting into your consciousness, something like a psychic ability or psychic phenomenon. So this general metaphor would predict that psychic abilities are real. They're not actually paranormal. They're not anomalies. They're what you'd expect to be true. And likewise, if one whirlpool stops being a localized whirlpool, the water just flows back into the broader stream. That means that analogously, that when the body dies, the consciousness doesn't die. It just transitions into a new form. And even you could see a new whirlpool forming potentially within the stream. So recycling of the water, and that would be something analogous to reincarnation. So the idea with this kind of a metaphysical framework where consciousness is the basis of everything rather than the material world, this view is actually that the material world emerges within consciousness itself. That's the upside down thinking. So if consciousness is primary versus consciousness is secondary to matter, those are the two paradigms that I've been looking at. And that was my initial paradigm shift. I think the more I look at it, the more I don't think that the brain creates consciousness, or more generally, that consciousness comes from the material world. There's something else where consciousness is playing a much more fundamental role, and that really changes everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And that then leads into sort of your exploration, looking at people. There's so much massive body of work with NDEs, so near death experiences, and it seems like it's so consistent, like the information, the the life of you and the places that they go to, and the fact that they can literally, if they're being operated in, they're literally aware of it all, but not in the body space, literally beyond it. Have you come across the first book that really tuned me into this was Michael Talbot's book, Holographic Universe. And reading through that, I was just saying, probably yourself, reading that just like totally expanding my consciousness and just blowing my mind. And then off the back of that, you start to see synchronicity start showing up in your life, which lead you on to the next stuff. And that's almost for me became like the proof that, wow, I was then seeing it in my reality, how things were sort of interconnected. But yeah, moving back to the NDEs, get your insight on them.
Yeah, that's a big one, and there are lots of debates. If you just Google it, near-death experiences, there are mainstream articles that say, "Look, we just proved that those near-death experiences that seem so remarkable, they are just a product of residual brain activity, and there's nothing special going on." But there are many phenomena that challenge that belief system, and some would even call it wishful thinking to say that near-death experiences are just products of brain activity, because that preserves the worldview that consciousness comes from the brain. There's nothing spiritual. There's a phenomenon called the veridical out-of-body experience that you were referring to, where a person describes their consciousness hovering outside the body, sometimes even outside the room that their body's sitting in. And then when they're resuscitated, so this might be during cardiac arrest or some other major trauma to the body, when they come back to the body, sometimes they tell the doctor or family members, "Look, I saw this or I heard this from a vantage point from outside my body," things that were not possible physiologically, given where the body was. And sometimes, in the best case scenario, the doctors can timestamp when the memory occurred because they know what the memory was, and they can say, "Look, this is what your body was doing because we have your, we can, we were measuring what was going on. And you should not have been able to have had such a clear consciousness, let alone one from a vantage point outside your body." Phenomena like that, the key is that they're veridical, meaning that they're validated memories. Meaning, by definition, they are not just hallucinations. And often the argument in the mainstream is, well, a near-death experience is a hallucination caused by a dying brain. So another example of veridical experiences, Dr. Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia has looked into this phenomenon. Cases where people in the near-death state, meaning their consciousness is in some other realm, they encounter what they would call the spirit of someone who died, but that was not known to have died prior to seeing the spirit. So it's information that could not have been known and was revealed during this out-of-body state, during the near-death experience, which suggests that something, when consciousness is liberated from the brain, actually more information becomes available, that our brain is limiting our experience, and a near-death state, like perhaps psychedelics or meditation experiences or things that we see with savants, where when the brain is tamped down, consciousness expands in a certain way. And Dr. Bernardo Kastrup wrote an article about this. I believe it's called Transcending the Brain in Scientific American, where there's more happening when the brain is shut down, which suggests that there's a lot more beyond what our senses ordinarily show us.
And then that obviously links very well into the idea of reincarnation and past lives. And that I know you've in your own books, and I've heard you talk before, and I've done my own research on this as well, like how children are coming in, and from a young age they're able to they talk to their mums and dads, and they're saying, oh, I was this person, I died in this plane crash or wherever. And the kids become so fixated with it. And then it gets followed up, and the research shows that how could they possibly know? It's not as if they were saying that I was Henry V in a previous life. They're saying about someone that no one would generally know about.
Yes, so these are instances studied at the University of Virginia, for example. I like to mention that because this sounds like a pretty crazy idea to those who haven't heard it before.
Yeah.
But the Division of Perceptual Studies at the Medical School at University of Virginia has been studying this since the 1960s. Started with Dr. Ian Stevenson, a child psychiatrist, who came across cases like this of young children, often between the ages of 2 and 6 years old, plus or minus, describing specific things about a life that is not their own. And like you said, Rob, these are not just people claiming that they were Cleopatra or some famous figure. It's a World War II fighter pilot or a Hollywood extra. These are very weird, specific, sometimes even nondescript lives. And in the strongest cases, over 2,500 of cases that have been studied at the University of Virginia, the strongest ones are the ones where researchers can find historical data that actually supports what the children are describing. So validating this life that the child remembers. And in some cases, children even have birthmarks or physical defects that align with the death in the previous life. So in these strong cases, the researchers can find medical records and say, yeah, there was a person that died in this manner. The child has these physical deformities or birthmarks that align with the death in the previous life. What's going on here? Well, we think the most parsimonious explanation is that that this child is somehow embodying the consciousness of someone who lived before.
Yeah, it's just, it blows your mind, in particular when I think about birthmarks, because I think about some of the birthmarks I had as a child, like literally a red dot at the top of my head. And my youngest daughter, who's just been born now, she's got this like red mark about 2 inches in diameter on the back of her head. And it just makes you think, you know, just often we dismiss these things. And who knows, that could just be, you know, but it could very well be linked to it. I'm interested to know, obviously, you're such an incredible researcher and you've gone down so many paths. I'm wondering, understand, have you have any direct experiences yourself with doing things? For instance, have you worked with anyone who would do, you know, who would do hypnosis or anything like that for you to maybe to help you sort of embed or validate from your own perspective some of this beyond just actually, you know, seeing all the science out there or the data?
Well, when I started researching this in 2016, I was interested in experiencing everything myself. So I started to work with psychics, astrologers, energy healers, hypnotists. I tried all that stuff. And I would say that my personal experiences are pretty limited. I mean, there were some instances where people did things or they knew things about me that I just couldn't explain. Like, clearly they got information. There's no way they could have known these things. So that happened a few times, but not always. And there were some things that were incorrect. So my exploration has largely been through looking at the science and the data of it. And the phenomena themselves are ephemeral. So they don't happen 100% of the time. Like I said, sometimes these psychic phenomena, people are they guess correctly beyond what random chance would predict, but they're not guessing correctly every time. So I think there's this false belief that if a psychic gets something wrong, that means psychic phenomena are not real. No, the question is, can the psychic get something correct more than chance would predict? And that means something, some kind of information is getting through. And that's kind of been my experience, where I will have strange synchronicities sometimes, where it just, like, when I run the math in my head, this does not seem like a coincidence. I can't prove that, but there are very strange events that happen over and over again, or I work with a psychic and something happens. So it's been pretty benign for me, whereas other people you might talk to, they've had these blowout experiences, and for them, there's no doubt at all. For me, it's been much more of a gradual intellectual experience. And I would say this, Rob, that my own life has been maybe the most mystical aspect, the way that it's evolved and gone into these other areas, and that the way the books seem to be coming out. It's really weird. Like, if you had known me before all this happened, like, this is the last thing I would have predicted. And the way that it's gone so smoothly. And even when I wrote the first book, I was still working in my job. I didn't know I was even going to find a publisher. Like, the way things have happened, it's been seamless in a way that seems orchestrated, or like something's going on that we might call paranormal.
Absolutely. And when you first released your first book, how was it? There must have been an element for you thinking, because anyone who'd known you before this would have known you, investment banker, Princeton University, so forth. And then all of a sudden, you're diving into this stuff and releasing this book. How did you feel first when you were, you know, releasing that first? Did you know, and then also, how was it received from, say, people that you've known for your life?
Well, the answer I'm going to give for this actually applies to all the books, where there was some anxiety before releasing the book, because I think there are people who will say that I'm crazy. And I had some people, even with my first book, which I would say is the most benign of the things I've written. They've gotten more and more controversial. But the first one is controversial. I'm questioning the nature of reality. I'm saying I think there's evidence that we don't die. These are big deal questions. I had some people who said to me, Mark, I really care about you, and you should not publish this. People are going to think you're nuts. And then I had a lot of people who are very supportive, and largely I've gotten support with all my books. There are the haters out there, and people that want to disown me or think that I'm crazy, but it seems to be a minority, or maybe I just don't encounter them so much. And the reception tends to be pretty positive. So there is a bit of an internal exercise with my own conviction with all this is having to overcome that hump to say that I think this is important enough to put the information out there. And I have to almost not care, even though I do care, I have to just not care how people react.
Yeah, and it's definitely taken you've taken the road less traveled, but also in that road there's so much more depth and wonder and just beauty to explore in that. And like I could have probably say to you maybe what are you thinking of doing next, and it's probably an element of maybe when we're in the investment world you probably would know what was going to happen over you'd be working in the next few years, but with this you're just open to see because you've written six books, you probably didn't know any of the first one what the second one was going to be or the third or fourth. And who knows what the seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth, or what other things that you will do. And it's just that it's just allowing life to flow and just being aware. And often a lot of people talk about when they create something like this, it's not even them. They are creating it, but there's something else supporting them doing it as well. Like it's there's something else pulling them along, whether you want to talk it from a soul perspective or just what needs to be put out into the world. And obviously that's your role at the moment is to deliver this information and put it out there. And because you do it in such a because of your background and how well you research and how well you write, like you say, everything's backed up. You have receipts for everything. It's not as if you're just it's just you're just make I'm not saying making it up, but you're just using your imagination to talk about stuff. That's literally backed up everywhere.
Yeah, so this is something I've actually taken from my academic and professional careers, where let's say in my professional career, I had to present to senior management team, CEOs, boards of directors. If I said something in a meeting, I would have to have the citation for where I got that information. So that's how I approach the books. And if your audience is interested in reading the books, there are hundreds of citations for all this stuff. So really what I'm doing and what I learned to do before I started writing books, interestingly, was to synthesize information. It's really not mine. I'm just synthesizing it in my way, but to make it absorbable and digestible because this stuff can be complex and it can take a long time, I know from experience, to go through all the data. What I try to do in my books is to put it all in one place for people who are very busy and put the sources there if they want to learn more. And that's really I think important because there is skepticism in these domains, and I can understand the skepticism because I've been a skeptic myself. And to know that there's that much data out there is really important. And then I also want to go back to your point, Rob, about like not knowing what's next, because that's been my path ever since I started this. And I'm very much there again. I mean, the sixth book was just published a few months ago. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I'm going to write another book. I've always said this. I may never write a book again. I'd have to find something that think is so paradigm shifting. So in my own journey, there is a bit of a process of surrender and to try to let go and to trust that things are going to unfold because it has before. And that is more and more difficult being outside of the professional world because writing books, I mean, in terms of just the financial aspect of writing books versus being in a stable investment banking career, or strategy consulting career, they're very different. In order to make money in the book realm, you have to sell a lot of books. And I'm writing about esoteric things. So I think there is a misconception sometime. I hear people say, well, oh, like this person's writing books. This is a great financial thing. The economics of that world are not that way. That's the reality is it's really tough there. So these are all the sorts of things I didn't have to think about before when I was in a stable financial career. Of like, well, can I follow passions and then also do things in a financially sustainable way? Is the universe going to present itself to me, or am I going to have to be more proactive and try to figure stuff out? It's an exercise in spiritual development, I think. All the practices you hear in spiritual traditions, I'm having to go through it myself, just like everyone in your audience is too.
Yeah, it is true, isn't it? And it's almost just maybe having that faith and trust in that you will always be provided for. You might not get always what you want from an ego perspective, but you'll always get what you need, and you'll always have Everything that pushes show up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, yes, it's really fascinating. And the amount of time, like I'll share some of it on the show notes of the other podcasts you've been on. I've just like really resonated and really enjoyed listening to you, to the journey that you've gone on, and just having that, because sometimes people can do a lot of this research into stuff, particularly like to move on to the ending upside down liberty shortly, and how about freedom. And a lot of people come into the freedom movement, but will leave consciousness at the door. And I think we can't, whichever path we're going to go down, that has to be fundamental. And you might be able, just before we delve into that liberty one, I'm sure you're probably aware of Dolores Cannon's work, maybe, and she would do, a hypnotherapist, and she specialized in some of the things we've spoken about. But she would talk about how, we live in a multiverse, and there's different parallel Earths existing now. And from that point, we're going down different time tracks, and potentially, we can. With this point now in humanity, it's like we, which path do we want to go down? Because it can look, you put the news on, it can look like World War III's coming, and who knows? It actually, I don't know what's going to unfold, but it's almost like charting our course for ourselves. And it seems like I think about you. If you go back before you would have left the investment banking world, that path, that version of you, almost still exists in a different timeline. But you've literally just, you're going off there, and this journey is. Well, it's going to be much more rich, and obviously, and think you think about what you're helping. Like I know from doing this podcast, I've had better feedback on doing my podcast than from anything I've ever done in my life, and on my work and career and stuff. But some of the interviews I had, and you have people come back and say, "Oh, that really helped me." And I think, well, that does it for me. That's like, and there's no money in it for me on the podcast, but it's like, so I do have to have a foot in both camps at the moment. Until whatever unfolds. But yeah, anyway, I just thought I'd touch on that.
Yeah, there's a fulfillment that comes from this that I didn't feel previously, for sure. And then there's also the element of knowing that I will reach people, whether it's today or many, many years in the future, just like you are as well, Rob. And we don't know how it's going to affect people. We may never hear from them. So there is a it's a bit of a disconnect relative to what I was doing professionally, where I had clients and there's direct feedback because I'd be in the room with them, I'd see how the work is being received. Whereas this kind of work, doing podcasts, writing books, the vast majority of people who take in my work, I will never hear from them, and I'll never even know they took in my work. So there is a degree of faith there to just do it. And I have to think back to my own process when I was listening to health shows and Extreme Health Radio and Laura Powers and Healing Powers and all the other podcasts that I've listened to and all the books I've read, where I probably will never speak to the people that I heard, but they had a major effect on my life.
Yeah, you make a really good point there about timing, and I think it's the same in our own lives. You were supposed to switch on for stuff in, was it 2013, 2014, you said at that point.
Yeah, the things started to shift in my life, but it was 2016 when I actually tangibly shifted. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if you would have been open to that information 5, 10 years earlier, it just wouldn't have come into your consciousness. You just wouldn't be ready for the shift. It's the same for me. I think about the things that I am interested in now. If someone would have said this to me 10 years ago, a bit like what you're saying, I would have said, you would have think I'm nuts. Like, no, like I've got my worldview. That's just the way life is. But yeah.
And also, it speaks to not forcing people, which can be hard, especially when I have so much enthusiasm to say, like, I would love for you to learn about this, but it might not be their time. Like, it wasn't my time. And there are things that I know now, and things like in the realm of liberty and politics, they weren't on my radar when I wrote my first book in 2017. I didn't even really care about politics at the time. And now I wish I would have known back then, but I wasn't ready for that. So we're all on our own unique journeys. That's what I've come to appreciate.
And it also, something else that I've come to appreciate as well is to realize that the only person you can change is yourself. But by being an example, you can potentially inspire other people to change as well. And that's all you can do is potentially be an inspiration for them. You can't, actually say, like, there's sometimes, we've all had in our lives, just say, if only this thing would be so good for you. If only you would do this, or if only you would practice this, or only if you'd read this book, it would just help you. But that's it. You've just got to, that's where you got to hold yourself back and just go, well, I'm going to make the changes within myself. And then other people will naturally see that, go, oh, Rob's changed, or Mark's changed. And then they'll take an interest in that, because they'll see that you will be, happier, you'll be enjoying life more, you'll be more excited about things, and that people just naturally it's like a gravitate towards that.
Yeah, that's right. And at some level, if we want to get really metaphysical, there is no other. There is no world. All there is the self, the whirlpool that's part of the stream. So naturally, it would make sense that all we can really do is focus on ourself because the self is the nature of reality at the highest level. And then also, you're describing something I've struggled with is this tendency to want to save the world. And I felt this much more early on. And I've let go of it a lot more because number one, I don't think it's possible. Number two, maybe it's not there to be saved. It is the way it is because it's whatever this place is supposed to be that way. And the best thing that anyone can do is work on themselves, and then the world as a byproduct may change positively, but the work is done internally and then in our family systems and then working outward. So it's really looking inward first and foremost, and then being of service from that place.
Yeah, 100%. So just moving into the book about liberty. Obviously, I think what happened to us a lot through COVID, maybe a lot of us who were researching stuff, say in the, from 2012 onwards or wherever it was, people going way back, it was just generally research and you were hearing about stuff. But then all of a sudden COVID hits, and then the things that we're suddenly hearing about in terms of, how authoritarian the governments can be and the structures in place, we're actually seeing it affect us all. So was that the inspiration behind the book for Upside Down Liberty?
Yeah, it was totally COVID. Also, looking at the 2020 election, Trump versus Biden. And so at this point in my life, I had written the first book that was published in 2018 and End Upside Down Thinking. I decided I was going to leave my firm right before all the lockdowns hit. And I wrote my second book, An End to Upside Down Living, which is on the spiritual awakening journey. It's partially autobiographical, my own journey, but really having looked at other people that have awakened in the modern era and historically, they're very similar messages. So I was focused on those spiritual, metaphysical questions at the time. And I was in a position where I had left my job and the world shut down. So I had an opportunity to study what was happening in the world politically, socioculturally, medically. And those were things I hadn't looked at much before. So I wasn't coming into this even with an understanding that governments could be authoritarian. That just wasn't it on my radar. So I had a very blank slate with regard to politics, and I saw what was happening very quickly in the COVID era and started to question this idea that governments are benevolent. And wait, how does this apply to thinking about structuring society more generally? And it led me into all sorts of political and economic theory, and ultimately writing my book and End Upside Down Liberty.
I think that's definitely the case. I think through COVID, if anything, the past few years, it's just brought even more things to light, hasn't it? I think the things that in the past, I think things as always things have been going on, but obviously with the internet and then with things happening, it just becomes almost it's opening a lot of people's eyes, really. So in the book, The Upside Down Liberty, you talk about the import stress the importance of private property rights, voluntary exchanges, and you also examine like the potential to, privatize the government's, poorly managed public sector. Just love to get an understanding from that element of the book, but also what you think is the more positive alternative paths that we need to go down.
Yeah, well, I want to preface this discussion by saying that this was a shift for me writing An End to Upside Down Liberty, the third book, because the first two appealed to people who had a spiritual interest. And what I learned very quickly is that having a spiritual interest or having certain beliefs about spirituality or religion don't correlate to political beliefs necessarily. So all of a sudden, I was writing about these political topics and totally splitting the audience. A lot of people who might have liked what I was doing before were very upset with what I was saying here, and other people were very happy with it because the general position in the Liberty book is that government, the way we do it around the world, is antithetical to fundamental spiritual principles, meaning that we tend to think of government, or we're trained to think of government, as a benevolent force that's there to take care of us, as a protector. Whereas the view that I have come to take is that it is inherently a predator. I know that's a big statement, because we live under governments. So, Mark, are you saying that we live in some kind of a predatory system where we're sort of enslaved, even though we feel like we're free? And that's exactly what I'm arguing, because governments, and when I my thinking evolved on this over time, and eventually I was led to the school of thought that's known as anarcho-capitalism, voluntarism. That's the terminology, but especially the work of Murray Rothbard and the Mises Institute, spelled Mises. They have a lot of free books available at Mises.org. Ludwig von Mises. So these are political thinkers who view government as a type of a service provider. Also, Larkin Rose, he wrote a book called The Most Dangerous Superstition for your audience. Government is a service provider, but unlike other service providers in society, such as a plumber, a lawyer, or me, like a strategy consultant, an investment banker, someone that you would hire to provide a service, government is not hired in that way. We don't have an explicit and mutually agreed upon contract with government as a service provider. Whereas I remember this in business, if we'd hire a lawyer, there'd be a contract and it would specify everything. This is what happens if you terminate the agreement. This is what the price is going to be. These are all the things that the service provider is going to provide, and so forth. We don't have that kind of an explicit and mutually agreed upon agreement with government. We have more of an implied consent. And this is really the key: explicit consent versus implied consent. Therefore, we end up with this structure that we call government. It's a political monopoly that can impose things on us that we didn't agree to, at least knowingly agree to. So they can say, you have to pay for these things that we're going to do as government. And whether you find those things to be moral or not, you're still going to pay for them. Call that taxation. Whereas if you hire a lawyer or a plumber, you're paying them for the service that you wanted. And if they don't do a good job, you're going to go to someone else. If government does a poor job, government doesn't go away. You might have different representatives, but the government's still going to be there. So it ends up in this predatory system where, in some cases, like in the United States, people would say that we found freedom. And certainly in the West, there are elements of freedom that we have today that have not been seen throughout history. But we also have more authoritarian forms of government where we see enslavement, explicit enslavement, we see genocide, and all sorts of problems. So the argument that I make in the book is that we need to see the flaws in the current governmental structures. Even though many of us feel like we're free, the problem is that the structure is set up such that those freedoms can be eroded over time. And we have to be aware of that, because things could get really bad. And there are plenty of examples throughout history, and even in the modern era, where governments do become very abusive to their citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard a good quote recently about, when a government lose authority of the people, they become authoritarian. And I think people, particularly over the past, it's probably been happening for decades, but particularly over the past so many years, people are waking up to the measures that have been put in place on people. So what do you see as the path to move down? What sort of green shoots are you seeing at the moment? One thing I thought just before I say that, I think maybe some of us that have gone past the past last through the past few years, and they'll hear about the WEF's agenda for 2030 and all these things that they're plenty putting into place. Some people I spoke to, you can feel quite disempowered by it. You can kind of feel like, well, it's gonna unfold. But also, on the other side of it, this isn't something that's just come about. These plans have been in the works and have been happening for decades anyway. It's not as if something's just going to happen. It's been happening and it is happening. But I think the more of us that become aware of it and can talk about, have these conversations, and particularly all the things that you're doing, we can potentially help in the coming years, help to formalize and materialize somewhat in our thinking what these new systems can look like.
And I agree that certain things are going to happen regardless of what we do. They're built into the system themselves. So maybe trying to change the system is going to be challenging unless someone is working from within it and can actually tangibly do that. For most of us, I think the change is within, and recognizing where the authoritarian tendencies exist, and then catering our lives accordingly, and then making decisions based on what we see. So we can interpret something that the media might tell us as a benevolent movement and say, actually, no, that's authoritarian. So we can make our own decisions. That's number one. And then number two, in terms of building a new kind of world, that's probably where we're headed if we do become free as a society. And it might take a long time. I don't know how it's going to unfold, where people start to build structures based on principles of voluntary exchanges that rely on explicitly mutually agreed upon contracts between a service provider and a consumer that wants that service. So starting to build those principles rather than building what we have now, where one group of people gets to decide for the rest of us what happens, and we call it democracy, and we say that's a good thing. Well, what is democracy really? Democracy is some people getting to tell other people what to do, even if that minority doesn't agree with it. That is authoritarianism. That's not freedom. And that's different from, so basically, there's a distinction between a compulsory democracy and a voluntary democracy. I would argue under governments, we have compulsory democracy, where it's mob rule. Just because it's more people who say something is right doesn't mean it's the right thing. And yet that's how democracy works, and the minority gets punished. Whereas, let's say there's a business arrangement between business partners, and they get together and say, voluntarily, this is how we're going to structure things. It is going to be the majority that gets to make the decision. But in the process of signing the contract to make the business work that way, you have voluntarily said that it's going to be this way where the majority gets to rule. So really, you have ceded your right voluntarily versus a compulsory democracy that we have in our governmental structures. So those kinds of distinctions are the things I think would start to happen more often in this more idealistic society. I would argue it's one that's more in alignment with natural law, but it's idealistic in that it's a shift from the status quo.
Yeah, 100%. It obviously also ties in what we're talking about, somewhat like that famous like Buckminster Fuller quote, isn't it? You know, you never change the things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So if we can focus that down those paths and see what's going to come about from it, then they can just potentially fall away. And I actually think they are crumbling. They're falling away as we speak, and they have been for quite some while, because when if we think about the world as an element of from consciousness perspective, and if we are evolving and shifting to a new paradigm, then just naturally they have to kind of crumble and fall away. One thing I'm interested to hear from yourself is, because you've worked in finance for so long, what do you think about sort of, you know, the obviously the generally the current system and the level of debt? I've heard some people talking about potentially, you know, it's going to reach a certain point where it's just getting to be unsustainable, and it can't be propped up any longer. And some people talk about a super crash or wherever. What are your thoughts? I know that you've said about really we should just focus on ourselves and make the changes within, but from your trajectory and from your history, what do you think that is happening? And
Well, this is a relevant question even for the individual because it would determine where we allocate our assets. Because if we're concerned about the market, maybe we take money out of the market and buy gold, or depending on what your preferences are. So this is very relevant, even though we maybe can't control what the system does. Now, as I've gotten more into this, what's known as the Austrian School of Economics, it's very much aligned with principles of voluntarism and the political stuff I've talked about. And the Mises Institute, like I mentioned, does a really good job of getting this information out there. I find that that school of economic thought, which is very pure, tends to be pretty apocalyptic about the current system because the system is not built on fundamentals. And therefore, there are predictions of horrible things that are going to happen with the economy. There's another part of me that was within the system and realizes how many interests are vested in the market doing well, for example, how much money is out there and how many people want it to do well with their pension funds and retirement and all these things. So there are forces in the market that are going to want to prop up a system that might have poor fundamentals, but will still do well because that's how the world is going to work. And because of that, I don't really have an opinion on what's going to happen because I don't know. And it's hard to time these things. There are so many forces at work, so much money that's going to steer things in different ways, so many interests. I don't feel equipped to even answer that.
That's fair enough. And then coming back to the idea of government and stuff, I heard a really good quote from yourself in one of the recent interviews. You talk about we need to spiritualize our lives and then get the government out of our lives. And I think that's just naturally as more of us become aware and maybe feel how suppressed we've been and controlled. And you start to realize, I had it a few years ago, I was thinking, God, I thought I was tuned into stuff, but God, I've just gone to many other levels now. And you don't, you just bought into it because you just, that's, it comes down to education, doesn't it? It comes down to our society, but particularly education. As soon as we get thrown into the system, we're taught this one world view of things and you just accept it. But then you come to a certain point where you wake up into what's happening around you. And I know some people I know can get quite angry to start off with it. It can be generally maybe a little bit of a phase that some people need to go through because they can be feel frustrated that they've had the chains put on them. But then also it's also very liberating to realize that and potentially obviously when we tune into the consciousness side of things that actually we're the ones in control of it all and we can shift and we can change it and make a huge dramatic changes in our lives and the lives around us. And I think you talked about it earlier on. You were start researching all this stuff and you felt alone. There wasn't many other people probably in your circle. And then all of a sudden, as you explore it, you put the books out, you do podcasts, you just open up to a new network of people that you'd never be aware of. And we build community. And I think that probably ties in with the idea of the new systems that we need. We need, you know, we need to build that sense of community, decentralized systems, but also in a sense from a community base.
Yeah, I do think community is really important from the perspective of not only building the new world, but moral support, because it can feel isolating to have these beliefs and understandings when the majority of the world doesn't. And I think more and more people are waking up, for sure. I mean, myself included. So that's encouraging. But having that community is really important. So I think the shows like what you're doing, Rob, are so important because they let people know that you're not alone, and then it also provides a platform to find other like-minded people.
And then I think it comes to another level where people, I think initially your community starts online to extend with random people. But it's, I think it's really important that we find, you know, we're doing real life. We're getting together in groups and it's away from technology to an extent because we need to build those grassroots movement, but also locally. But as we've seen, it's been really interesting. Sometimes you just have a conversation with someone and something just pops in my head to say, I should ask them this question and just to do a little bit of a probe. And then all of a sudden they're open to something and you're like, wow, you know, often you can have a sense, probably be yourself and other people. You could think, oh, I didn't think they would be into that, but they are. And people would look at me and think, I didn't realize you were into that, Rob, but you are. And I think it's just being a little bit brave, maybe not to go all in on the, you know, maybe the near death experiences and the past lives straight away, as you would say, but maybe just start like, and then all of a sudden, like I've built up some beautiful friendships the past half a dozen to a dozen years of stuff. And they become, when times are challenging and tough, they become like a bedrock for you. You know, if you want to meet them, catch up with them, talk about them, an outlet for you that you might not generally have day to day sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, you're reminding me that sometimes it's just a little idea that can be the first domino that then shifts someone years later. So, for example, the idea that the brain is like an antenna, and that when you have a television set and you smash the antenna on the TV set, the antenna breaks and you watch. You try to watch TV and the show doesn't appear on the screen. It's all scratchy. It's because the antenna was broken and the signal hasn't been broken. It's just that the apparatus for receiving the signal has been broken. And if you start to think about, wait, is our brain like that? Is our body like that? That is an idea I'd never heard of before. So someone might hear that for the first time and it's sort of like in the back of their mind all the time. Wait, how do I know for sure that that's not true? What Mark said. So sometimes in conversations, it might be like you said, where they you didn't realize they were interested in it, or you drop a hint, and it's like a seed that grows over a long time.
Yeah, 100%. I've done actually. I remember I've got a friend particularly that I dropped a few little seeds to him, and his roots and his trees have grown way farther and faster than mine since that time. He's just gone exponential with stuff. But that's yeah, it's really interesting when you think about that. And I think about how interconnected we are, and I like to think it's important that when we become aware of this stuff, we share it if we can share it, and you share it for your books and for your podcasts and for the interviews you do, and just share it for that willingness of like, I'm just going to put it out there. I find this information empowering. I find it's changing my life. Just to put it out there, and then other people give an opportunity then to see what they want to do with it. I almost feel like it's just a, like if you talk about stuff like, for instance, I think I've heard you speak about it, and I resonate with this. Like, who am I actually speaking to now? Am I just speaking to another reflection of myself on some level? And same with you, but we're agreeing to this on some level that we're going to interact. So we can take that potential that viewpoint on it. Then you just become, it just shifts everything. Can absolutely shift everything.
Yeah. Well, the notion that there is an intelligence underlying the universe and that things aren't just happening completely randomly. It might appear to be random from our vantage point, but from a higher perspective, it's all coordinated or something like that. It takes away what I used to have, which was this desire to control everything and to micromanage everything. That naturally goes away. It becomes a form of arrogance to think that we can control everything. With this expanded view, even if we don't understand exactly how it works, then like you say, life starts to flow in a different way. And then every interaction, every event in life starts to appear just different than it was before.
And I think it ties in well with what's happened the past few years. As things expand, and I think things are expanding on many levels, it shows that the systems that are in place no longer serve humanity. And the light is being shined on them even more. And that's why they naturally have to crumble, because everyone on some level is shifting, I believe, and expanding, because that's probably why we've chosen to be here at this time. To explore it. But during that, we have to see, probably go through some great hardship at times as well, and so many challenges. But it's in those challenges that we grow. I'm a big believer in, what you go through is that's what you grow, that's how you grow as well.
And an important distinction here is that I think the vast majority of people would agree with you that our systems aren't working, but they might disagree on the way in which they're not working. So there is a discernment that's going to be needed. And the term that I've used in my books is compassion with discernment. These are two almost independent tracks that we need to become more compassionate and understand that we're interconnected and so forth, but then also to discern what the right path forward is. And that can be a challenge, especially when we exist in a world of deception, where there are things that on the surface appear to be benevolent, but underneath they're actually not. So some would call it the wolf in sheep's clothing. This is a very important distinction because we see this in the realm of politics. People will say, yeah, the system's broken, but this is what we're going to do to fix it. And then people on the other side of the aisle say, no, we're going to fix it in the opposite way. And there needs to be more unification around these ideas, which to me will come from a greater understanding of whatever the truth is. And right now, we're all trying to discern what that truth is, and we're coming to different conclusions.
And also, I know from my own journey is what I suddenly thought was the truth a few years ago, just new levels come to me all the time. So for me to say this is how we should go down, the path we should go down, it could be completely wrong. I think that's another thing for me as well, is to just say I could be wrong about this, and just have that. Like, sometimes I'll share stuff on certain podcasts and go, well, I don't know if this is true. I don't know, but I'm willing to investigate it and explore it and see what path it takes me down. And then just be open to basically not to be rigid with my view about stuff, and be open to keep changing and opening up to stuff.
Yeah, and being willing to have been wrong, to say, wow, I actually don't think what I used to think before, which is a hard, it's a challenge to the ego, but it's part of this process because I'm constantly having to revisit my beliefs and say, oh, I used to think that, or I had this assumption before, and now I'm not so sure of that assumption. So now I have to rethink everything from that. So that's an it's a form of an intellectual humility that's required in this process.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I'd like to talk about your most recent book now, which sort of ties in nicely with a lot of things we've been talking about, particularly looking at the idea of liberty and stuff, and but obviously an end to upside down health, and how you are certainly poking holes in the allopathic medicine model. So I'd love to just get an understanding of, I've actually been listening to the audiobook. I'm right to the end of it now. I didn't quite get a chance to finish it before we spoke, but I certainly got it was so much information, and like we touched on early on, you cite so many researchers, so many doctors, so many scientists about stuff, which can help to people just blow our worldview of what we thought medicine was.
Yeah, well, we talked about consciousness earlier, and that's ultimately the biggest revolution in medicine is understanding what a physical body is. If we have a soul or a consciousness that embodies this body, that means our body's like a vehicle or a vessel, and that there might be things like past lives or whatever that means that impacts our physical body, where there's a birthmark or a physical defect because of something in our consciousness. These are the sorts of things like a near-death experience. I reference in my book Anita Morjani, one example out of many spontaneous healings. She had terminal cancer, went into a near-death experience state while she was in a coma, shifted her consciousness completely because she realized things about her psychology that she cared too much about how people thought of her. She was resuscitated and her tumors disappeared. These sorts of stories blow apart the conventional allopathic system. But that's really the second half of the book where I get into that stuff. And the first half, I try to stick with the more mainstream views of medicine. And even that is really a mind-blowing exploration. I mean, it shifted my paradigm so much. But I'll go back to the analogy of firefighters at the scene of a fire, right? We can't automatically conclude that firefighters caused the fire just because they were there. And similarly, now if we think about why people get sick and what are the determinants of health, often we'll say, well, there were a lot of bacteria there. There was an infection. Therefore, the bacteria caused you to get sick and die. Well, there were bacteria there, but were the bacteria there as enemies, or were they there to help clean up underlying toxicity? And the bacteria got blamed, but the reason the person was sick is because they had some other toxicity. They were exposed to environmental toxins, or they had psychological toxicity that resulted in something. So the exercise ultimately in this question of medicine and health is trying to understand what causes good health and what causes disease, departure from health. And are microbes, microscopic organisms, the cause of illness, or are there other explanations? That's really what it comes down to. And it's like I said before, with regard to consciousness, there are observations that we can make. And in the field of medicine, they're called epidemiological observations, meaning patterns of sickness in society. And often we then want to jump to a conclusion. This pattern existed. Oh, therefore, there must have been a virus going between people. We don't see it with our eyes, but it's going from person to person. It's invading the cells and replicating, and it's causing all these symptoms and it's causing the death. That can explain the pattern of illness that we see. And what I've found is we don't often enough ask the question, well, what else could explain those observations of sickness? Was there something else in common that people were exposed to that wasn't a virus, wasn't a bacterium, wasn't some microbe that caused the symptoms? And so really that's what I try to do in the book. I point to many doctors who have done this way before me. I'm new to this and I'm synthesizing their research. But there are many explanations that we can come up with for every illness and every quote unquote infectious disease where we say, well, nope, it was just this virus. There are problems with the narrative that I didn't realize, and there are other explanations that can get us closer to the true determinants of health.
Yeah, 100%. And one thing I've become, it's come through in your book, and I've heard you speak on other podcasts, and I've become aware of it from other things, is people are talking about obviously this no virus debate, which is obviously quite controversial to say the least for some people, because that can potentially blow a lot of people's worldview and everything that they've ever believed of. But also it's very empowering. But maybe it could be good to get a bit of understanding for the audience, like, what's the difference between, say, germ theory and, say, terrain theory?
Yeah, this is a big debate and it's been going on for a long time. Pasteur versus Bichamp, 1800s, people were talking about like what is it that causes disease? And with Bichamp, I mean, excuse me, with Pasteur, he was looking at rabies and saw dogs were getting sick and then people who got bitten seemed to get sick. And he was looking for a mechanism to explain this, but he couldn't see anything. He didn't actually isolate a viral particle to explain what was causing the sickness. He said, oh, there must be a virus there. There must be something that we can't see. And the term virus, long ago with the Greeks, it meant a poison. It didn't mean what it means today, which is a protein-encased set of genetic material that gets inside of a host cell and replicates, and then it explodes out and then goes into another cell and it causes some set of symptoms. Very specific definition that we have today. And the debate is, well, ultimately the debate is why do people get sick? But the debate over the virus is, has that definition of a virus, the specific one that I just described, has that ever been found before? And most of your audience, if you're not familiar with it, they'd say, well, obviously it's been found. Look at all these viruses. We just lived through a virus over multiple years. And so I'll just go through some of the basic counter arguments to, so there's this group of people who says there's no virus that has ever been established as a replicating, intracellular parasite, that definition. Sure, there might be poisons that exist. And maybe that's when people will say virus. Yeah, we're talking about some kind of a poison. Maybe it's a physical poison, a psychospiritual, emotional poison. Yeah, that exists. But this more specific definition of the picture you see on the screen, that hasn't been shown to exist. And the key parts of the argument, which I'm synthesizing what other people have done. And in my book, I cite all the sources with this stuff. And I would recommend your audience, there's a library called The End of COVID at theendofcovid.com that really helped open my eyes because there's like over 100 hours of interviews on this stuff. So I'm going to synthesize that position. If you see a picture on TV where they say this is a virus, most people will say, look, you proved it. We saw it under a microscope. Well, what you're seeing is an image under an electron microscope, which is a static image of something that's dead. So you're not even seeing it in its natural habitat, and it's been sliced up. There's resin on it. Sometimes the temperature's been changed, and you're looking at an image of that. You're not seeing something moving that's actually getting into a host cell and replicating and all that sort of thing. But then there's a secondary question of, okay, you might be right about all that, Mark, but still you're just seeing a dead virus. Okay, well, what's the sample that dead virus came from? And the answer is that it comes from what's known as a cell culture. It's a soup of material, because the classic experiment that was conceived in 1954, the Enders and Peebles study, that was initially the one that got people to say, oh, this is how we have isolated a virus, and now we can see it for the first time, is they would take fluids from a person who's sick, and maybe the fluids would be filtered partially, and they'd put those fluids into a soup of material called a cell culture. And that soup would have things like antibiotics, monkey kidney cells, a whole bunch of toxic stuff, actually. And the experimenters would look to see if cells broke down in that soup once they added the fluids from a sick person. And if cells broke down, they'd say, look, there was a virus in the fluids from a sick person. Now, there are, of course, many other explanations as to why the cells might have broken down. Well, maybe it's because there's toxic stuff in the soup. And if you ran a control study to see what happens to the soup without adding any fluids from a sick person, maybe you'd see cellular breakdown. And there have been some studies where that happens. You don't even add the alleged virus and things break down. But also, might there be something in the fluids from a sick person, even if they're partially filtered, that would cause some kind of a reaction in the soup, meaning it's not just a virus? These are questions that aren't being asked. These are questions really of logic more than anything else. And what happens is, well, the cells break down. It's called a cytopathic effect. The experimenters say, well, there must have been a virus there. Now let's look at the cell culture under an electron microscope, which wasn't even invented until the 1930s. So prior to that point, talk of a virus was really speculative. But let's look at it under an electron microscope. We're going to have to kill it. And it's going to be outside of its natural habitat. It's not in the body doing all the things we're told it does. And we're going to look at it, and then we're going to see what's there. So hopefully what your audience gleans just from that little story is that there's a lot more going on. It's a lot more complicated than we're told of, oh, scientists, they isolated a virus, and now we know that it's contagious, and so forth. There are a lot of layers that I think a lot of doctors aren't even aware of in terms of the methodologies and the problems with the methodologies and the ways in which they don't follow the scientific method. Number one, without having an isolated virus first, meaning a virus that's been separated from other things, you don't have an independent variable in your experiment. And you kind of need an independent variable in order to test whether that variable is causing the things you say it's going to cause, i.e., sickness and death. And then number two, there need to be proper controls. in the study. And those two things seem to be problematic across the field of virology.
Another thing that's come up about the no virus debate is that, well, it's not been isolated, has it? And I believe there's been Freedom of Information Acts put about for, is it 200 of them or something around the world?
Yes. So what Christine Massey has coordinated many of these freedom of information requests, where she and her colleagues ask medical organizations all over the world. So it's in 40 countries, over 200 organizations have been asked these sorts of questions. And it's not just with regard to SARS-CoV-2, but it's other viruses too, or what they would say are alleged viruses. They say, I want you to show me where this virus has been isolated. And they go through the technical steps and they say to the CDC or to other organizations all over the world, please show me the studies, just send them to me where the virus has been isolated first. And what they come back with is, we don't have any records, or this is impossible in the field of virology, because the field of virology does not actually isolate the virus in the traditional definition of the word isolation, which means to separate from other things. To the field of virology, isolation means, well, you run this cell culture soup and you show that there's an effect where the cells break down. To us, that's what isolation means. And then some people come back and they'll say, well, look, viruses are really hard to isolate. They're really little. Or viruses are parasites, so they're inside the cell. We're not going to be able to isolate that because it's inside the cell. And it begs the question, well, if it's going from cell to cell in the body to make your whole body sick, wouldn't it have to leave the cell, and wouldn't you be able to capture it there? So what happens is these excuses get made, and we don't see a pure isolation in terms of having an independent variable in a study. And you would need an independent variable to show that the virus is actually doing the things that it's alleged to do. And this applies not just to what's gone on in the last few years, but it applies to every alleged virus that's ever been discovered. That's what this no virus position is asking, is have they ever found that this intracellular parasite exists and is causing disease in its hosts? Or in every one of those cases, could we find another explanation as to why people might get sick in the same place around the same time? Were there toxins? Was there electromagnetic radiation? Was there electricity that people were exposed to? Was there a common emotional shock that they were exposed to? Why is it that some people in the same place at the same time get sick with similar symptoms and others don't? If the virus is allegedly so contagious, can we explain that very well? And as these questions are asked, what I found is that the doctors who ask the questions are not getting good explanations. They might get theories, but then if you say, show me the studies to back that up, they don't do it very well. And one more point on this, because I'm getting now into the realm of contagion, which is a key part of virology, is to believe that this particle not only exists, but it goes from person to person. That should be a very easy thing to demonstrate medically and scientifically. Okay, let's take some of this alleged viral material, put it in the air, and show that the people or the animals in the study get sick with similar symptoms. What do you find actually is that, number one, some of those studies have been done where they try to just in a natural way show contagion. So I talk about the Spanish flu studies that were done. They had people coughing in each other's faces and so on. Very natural means of transmission. Shouldn't most of them get sick? None of them got sick. That's pretty crazy. So there should be tons of studies like that. Or, like I said, these theoretical studies where you just put some of the virus in the room, whatever. How are the studies actually done? And many of these are old studies, like 100 plus years or just, many decades old. They inject animals with a cell culture that has other stuff in it, not an isolated virus. They inject them in the brain, in the trachea. And what do you know? Some of the animals get sick with symptoms. Sometimes they're not even the symptoms fully associated with the disease. And they say, look, it's contagious. We injected the animal with this thing. So that was very troubling to me, because contagion is, it governs our behavior so much, and it governs our fears, and can govern how authorities around the world make decisions. Shouldn't we establish this very concretely in a scientific manner, very clearly? Here's the isolated microbe. Here's how it causes symptoms very clearly in a natural setting. People, like in the same way that we bump into each other in society, let's show that in a study and show clearly this is causing the symptoms. That miraculously seems to be way more absent from the literature than I expected. And if you talk to some doctors, they will tell you it doesn't exist, Mark. We've looked around. We cannot find the studies showing contagion in a natural way.
Yeah, it's truly mind-blowing because it t ties back into what we've always just been told and believed. And it becomes that point where you are just, we've seen it through COVID, people literally scared of other people. They're scared of the invisible. And it ties in very well if a government wanted to control the people, or if they wanted to do, well, what better thing to do than to something than the, the boogie monster. So it's definitely been used to terrorize the population. But then I suppose from just to challenge it in some ways, like one thing that always comes back, doesn't it, like about chicken pox. So for instance, my daughter, coincidentally, she started nursery a few weeks ago, and she became unwell, and then my 5-month-old became unwell, and then I became unwell as well. So, but I've been delving into this information more, and I've come across German New Medicine recently, and how my daughter has definitely experienced separation anxiety from us. She's only known us for 3 3.5 years, and eventually we decided to put her into nursery for a couple of days a week because we think it'd be useful for her to be, interact with other little kids and play and stuff like that. But you've seen the emotional effect on it, and it had an emotional effect on me because I could see that bond going from. But looking at, say, Germany medicine, they would talk about how everything begins from the psyche and from that element to it. So it was that element. But then also chiming in with chickenpox, we got a message from the nursery last week to say, oh, chickenpox has ran loose through the nursery and kids are getting it left, right, and centre. So just be mindful of your daughter. My daughter didn't catch it. Or when they say, probably that's the wrong word to use now, isn't it? To use catch. I have to catch my terminology now and say, rather than catch, just has it. For some way, and that's going to take me a while to get used to not saying catch or whatnot, and it could be a while. And some people will be screaming at me listening to this now, saying, "What do you mean you can't catch something? Of course you catch something." But what do you think about that? Obviously, you've talked about that because there's other elements to it, whether it's EMFs, or has there been a psychological shock or whatever things. But most parents would be like, "Well, of course, you send your kid to nursery, they go to school, they come back with all sorts." That's what we generally hear and see.
So what I try to do in the book, and Upside Down Medicine, is go through some of these cases of alleged infectious diseases and show we don't know for sure why people are getting sick in these cases, but here are some alternatives. Because it's really a matter of deconstructing our psychology, where we assume people in the same place, they got sick with similar symptoms at the same time, they must have caught something, that there was something invisible that went from one person to the other, without examining, well, how do we know that's actually true? What's actually happening? Just what's the observation? The observation is similar symptoms are emerging around the same time in the same place. What is the cause of those symptoms? What might be a reason that people are showing up with those symptoms in the same place? So it would make sense to then ask, what are common elements of the environment? Is there a toxicity in the environment? Is there something in the nutrition that's going on? Is there a cell tower right near the nursery? Is there a similar emotional issue that people are going through? Are they all facing a separation conflict, or are some of them facing it more than others? Is there something seasonal going on? I mean, there are a million explanations that we could come up with. I mean, one example that people often reference is scurvy. 2 million sailors dying at sea. Their gums were bleeding, teeth were falling out. I mean, really serious symptoms. And it turned out there was a nutritional deficiency. If they started eating lemons and limes and had vitamin C, the symptoms go away. And it would be very easy to say, well, look, clearly there was some microbe in there getting inside their cells, spreading from person to person. And it's a matter of deconstructing our psychology and saying, well, actually, we're just thinking that it must be a spread when maybe there's something else to explain it. The firefighters aren't causing the fire. Maybe there's another explanation about what's going on. And that's really what this is about, an exercise in critical thinking. And it leads us to an uncomfortable place, I will say this, of saying, actually, I don't know why we get sick. Yeah, people get sick. They have symptoms, and sometimes they'll die from those symptoms, but we don't really understand why. And that's an uncomfortable place to be. And I'm glad that you mentioned German New Medicine. It's something I do mention in my book as well when I talk about consciousness, because consciousness blows this whole thing up when we start getting into the psycho-spiritual elements. But that's a really interesting emerging field. And I would love to see more science on it. I know there are practitioners that are seeing results. But the idea is that our illness, Our illnesses and symptoms come from emotional shocks. And I know, I believe there are exceptions. Like if you have a major exposure to a toxin, or if there's a major nutritional issue, that can override and that can be the root cause. But ultimately, what they're looking at in German New Medicine is what emotional shock, what if you have a certain symptom, to them, they can tell you the emotional shock that you're healing from. And when you're actually showing symptoms, that means you're healing from something and your body's getting rid of the excess tissue or whatever your body needed in order to heal itself. So the healing is actually an indication of the recovery. Excuse me, the symptoms are an indication of the recovery.
And from that perspective, because I've been delving into this stuff more recently, and I've had symptoms myself from things, and even before Christmas, I have had a different. I've just shifted my perspective on it, and that's so empowering to think, well, I'm not sick. I'm literally getting better. But this is just me showing up that I'm releasing something from me. I had something last November. It was crazy. I was dealing with some emotional things that were coming up for me. Loads of things that's coming up from the past. You know, we've all got it for some expected, but traumas were coming up, and I came across a doctor called Dr. Claire Weeks, who is an Australian doctor. She passed away, but she was all around in the 20th century, and she done a lot of work, particularly on. She was a psychologist, and I delved into a lot of her work, and she would talk about how you need to really, fundamentally, you need to feel what's going on. We can very much distract ourselves. We can have there's a myriad of things we can do right now to not feel our feelings. And I went through this exercise of feeling this feeling, and it got to the point where it moved down into my body, and then I felt this burning sensation in my tummy. But she explained that this was the process, and I felt it, so it was kind of empowering. But interestingly, about a week after, my eyes just blew up. I had my eye practically closed up. I had this big lump, sty on my eye. I just went to the chemist, and they were like, "Have you been bit by something?" It looked like it was multiple infections. But because I was becoming aware of this stuff, I was like, "Actually, no, I'm tying that in now." I obviously had an emotional release. I worked through some old stuff, and then my body had to then. There was another element to that healing, so the symptoms had to show up. And it's interesting because I could have just applied myself with antibiotics and done all sorts of stuff, but actually that would have just suppressed it back down and not allowed me to go through that process.
Exactly. This is a paradigm shift, because then we look at symptoms as a mechanism of healing rather than something to just get rid of. Excuse me. And in allopathic medicine, the model is often, let's just get rid of the symptoms. So it's really a reversal. And even from a spiritual lens, this is how I'm starting to look at it, is that our body is showing us things to work on. It's leading us in a direction that's evolutionary. And it's also, when it's giving us symptoms, it's showing that it's functioning properly. So it says, okay, I'm working to help you heal, and this is an emotional issue you might want to look at in the future so that you can avoid this discomfort that you have with the symptoms. So it really is a radical way of looking at things, and it's also difficult because it's not materialistic. And allopathic medicine is reductionistic in that it likes to find a material cause. It's much easier to think that way. Whereas here we're talking about something abstract. It's like, wait, you mean that some of the kids at school, they might have had a similar separation conflict, and maybe something in their age hormonally, when you combine it together, creates these symptoms? I don't know. I'm just totally speculating. But that's a hard sell, because it means that something in the mind, an emotion is turning into something physical that you can point to, rather than this microscopic thing that's going from person to person and actually invading your cells. That's an easier thing to conceptualize than something more abstract like our psychology or consciousness.
And with Germany medicine, obviously it's a big focus around cancer, but makes you think about there's such a fear. People say the C word. There's such fear about that, you know, that's been entrained in us for years. And I think going back decades ago, there's always been this war on cancer, but it's just got worse. And then you might turn on the TV and an advert would say one in two people are going to get cancer in their lifetime, or one in three people. And it just plays that fear mode. So when people see something or hear something, but then in Germany medicine, it'll talk about that actually the diagnosis shock as well. So not only have you had the psychological shock of, oh, what's this thing, but then another thing gets laid on top of you to say, you've got this, you now need to do this protocol. Or in some cases, they'll say, well, there's nothing we can do. It's terminal. And you think about that effect that it has on people. It's huge.
Yeah, so my understanding of German New Medicine, the explanation of what's known as metastasis, which is the belief in that the cancer is spreading, German New Medicine practitioners would say, well, you're having multiple conflicts and they're severe. So there might be the initial one that caused the cancer, then the diagnosis, that's its own emotional shock, which can cause a cancer, and so forth. So and again, it's like it's this correlation versus causation, or seeing observing things and then seeing or trying to come up with the causation. So you see cancer here and then cancer there, then cancer there. Our mind might say, well, it's spreading. But the word spread implies something. Could it be that these are separate emergences that appear as spreading? And we could even get even more metaphysical because I think about this with regard to time. We interpret sequence because of things in our mind. We remember something in the past. We have the present moment. We think about the future and we draw this linear line and say that the time works that way. Whereas maybe time is just an ever-present now where there's things emerging in the present moment, but it's just one big thing. And that's the exercise with all of this, is getting really clear on what we're observing and where we're drawing conclusions, where maybe we need to look at other explanations, always.
Yeah, and that's why I think a question that you've got or a statement is, why consciousness is so relevant to medicine and why it's so important. We can't leave, again, we've used it a few times in this conversation, you can't leave it at the door.
Can't, because then we'll just be stuck also in a materialistic reductionistic lens where it's just toxicity. It's just where our food's not clean enough. I mean, these are all important things. There's just too many EMFs. To me, it's all of it together.
Yeah.
But the consciousness seems to be fundamental and in some cases can override everything, like the Anita Morjani spontaneous healing. Her tumors disappeared after her consciousness shift in a near-death experience. This is one case out of many. Spontaneous healings where people sh shift their mindset and their symptoms go away.
Yeah.
Children have birthmarks and physical defects that relate to a previous life. How do we explain that from any conventional realm? I mean, the researchers at UVA, University of Virginia, they say, look, traditionally it's environment and genetics that we believe cause changes in our physical form. And now we have a third factor from these children with past life memories and birthmarks and physical defects, a third factor, a separate factor impacting our health. That's what I'm hoping to encourage with this book and these conversations, is that we need to be thinking way beyond the allopathic assumptions.
It makes me think of I've done a podcast on Dr. Joe Dispenza's work and me going
Yeah.
to an event there and seeing how powerful the shifts that people have, whether it they've been at an event for 3 or 4 days or they literally apply his techniques and do his programs over the course of a year or however it is, and the absolute shifts that they have. And it's absolutely phenomenal. It ties in very much with that spontaneous healing that obviously doctors just dismiss it, don't they? They're like, oh, it's if it's just they like a freak of nature or something, but it's so common. It's the same thing with the placebo effect. You can say to someone, this will make you better. And some people will believe that and it will make them better. But it's not actually the tablet that's made them better. It's just their belief that they're going to get better.
Right. And then that is how powerful is that? That something as abstract as a mindset can actually change our physical outcome, or the nocebo effect, where actually a negative expectation can make things worse. So it's an empowering idea on health, ultimately. As scary as it can seem to think that there's so much toxicity in the world, which I think is true, our mindset probably can counteract some of that. And maybe that's why some people get sick when exposed to certain toxicity and other people don't. That's still a mystery for me too. Like, how do we explain the variety of symptoms? It's usually not 100%. And it might be that I mean, first of all, we have different bodies. Not everyone has an identical body, but maybe there's different mindsets and maybe people are different, dealing with emotions differently. And when you're dealing with them better, there's less of a susceptibility to having symptoms or coming down with some kind of a disease. So I do hope that that's something your audience comes away with, that like the where our beliefs are and our thoughts are really powerful in terms of our health.
It can be a real shift and empowering. Some people can also maybe freak out a little bit about it as well, because they'll be thinking, oh, I've got so many negative thoughts each day and I'm always focusing on the negative and stuff. But and then they'll think, oh, I'm making myself sick. And in some ways we are. But I think one thing I've taken from it is that a positive emotion is so it completely is so much more powerful than, say, 100 negative emotions. And I
Yeah.
think when we have that shift on that, then it's just we can, yeah, you don't have to get necessarily get so hung up about maybe your bad thoughts.
Right. And we live in a world where negativity is encouraged. Turning on the news, looking at politics, there's a lot of negativity, a lot of fear and anger. So it's encouraged. And it takes personal responsibility to say that I'm not going to dive into the negativity. I'm going to understand that darkness exists and there are some unpleasant things in the world, but my mindset's going to be positive and I'm going to explore my beliefs. And there are lots of spiritual practices that can help people do this. Something I've been revisiting recently is Byron Katie's work. She wrote a book called Loving What Is, and she has these four basic questions around any belief. So think about any negative belief you have. She always encourages writing it down. She says there's something different about doing that because it doesn't get stuck in your head and the mind can corrupt it. So you write a negative belief about someone. Let's say it's Jane hates me. Okay, there's this woman, Jane, she hates me. And then you ask yourself, the first question is it true that Jane hates me? And you're like, well, yeah, I think it is. And the second question is, can I absolutely know it's true? And you're like, wait, I don't know for sure. And then she asks you to think about how it makes you feel to have that belief, to really go into that, and then to feel how you would be without having it. And then she asks you to turn it around. So that means changing the statement itself. So this belief that's causing so much struggle, Jane hates me. It's causing me so much internal turmoil. Well, Jane doesn't hate me. Try that. And then come up with examples of, wait, actually, in these cases, she was pretty nice to me. She might not hate me. And then changing the pronouns with it. I hate me, not Jane hates me. It's like, whoa, when I turn it around that way, maybe there's something within me that doesn't like myself and I'm projecting it on her. So my point here is there are techniques that we can all employ. It can take some work to do this. And I mean, it can be a long time it takes for these healings to occur, but sometimes it can be spontaneous when you're like, whoa, I hate me. There's something within me and there can be healing within that. But it takes often the decision internally to want to look at these things. And then what that can do in terms of our cascading health and the way that we feel, it can be pretty miraculous.
Absolutely. In the end, it comes down to taking radical self-responsibility, doesn't it, for every area of our life and realizing that we're the ones that can change it. Well, Mark, I'd love to continue talking all day and night, but I know we've got things to do. I'd ask you what you're doing next, but I already know that you don't know what you're doing next. But what I would like to know is, like, where can I direct the audience to find out more about your books, your work, your podcast that you've done in the past? That would be great.
My website is a good place to go. It's markgober.com, markgober.com. I have social media sites, Instagram, Telegram, Facebook. It's Mark Gober Author for Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And it's for Telegram, it's Mark Gober Official. And I periodically post things that I'm interested in. But like you said, I'm not sure what's next. We will see. And I just want to thank you for all that you do, Rob, and thank you for having me on.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I've really, really enjoyed every second of it.